It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case that brought up issues of same-sex marriage, business accommodations, and free speech. We'll check out the arguments and what's at stake. First, at various points over the last couple of years, we've checked in with writers and authors about what they're reading and recommending to others. We talked to author and professor B.J. Hollers last fall about a collection of essays he edited from Wisconsinites on the topic of hope. B.J. is back with us now to talk about some of his favorite new books he's read in 2022, and you could do the same at 800-642-1234. Did you have a favorite brand new book you had a hard time putting down this year, or maybe one that was new to you? It doesn't have to be 2022 published. Did you discover any new and exciting authors? Do you have a reading method of choice, physical copy, e-reader, phone, audio? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. B.J. Hollers is an associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. He's the author of several books, including 13 Loops, Race, Violence, and the Last Lynching in America, and The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. B.J., welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, now you're an English professor. I'm guessing you do a lot of reading and rereading along with your classes. You're an author writing your own books. When do you find time to read books?
Well, a lot over the last week since I got your email, let me tell you. But I had a great time kind of reconnecting with a lot of books I'd had on my list throughout the year, and I got through a lot of them, thankfully.
Excellent. Any themes standing out to you in 2022 when it comes to fiction or nonfiction?
You know, it's hard for me to pick out themes. I think one thing I'm seeing a lot from my students too is the interest in kind of moving beyond the real world. There's a lot of fantasy elements that these seem to be enjoying and kind of video gaming, which is going to get us to the first fictional book. But in terms of nonfiction, I see a lot of, you know, kind of cultural histories of places, which we might talk about, but also people from the past, historical figures coming out and being thought of in new ways.
And before we start naming names, your list includes some novels, some historical fiction as part of that, literary fiction, essays, memoir, nonfiction. I know sometimes I get into a reading rut. Can you encourage people to, you know, maybe try diversifying? If you always read one thing, maybe check out something else.
You know, there's a quote that my friend says, and I think about this a lot. He says, reading can be a mirror to reflect yourself or a window to peer out of. And so I like that metaphor of especially the window part of it. You know, expand those horizons, try to learn something beyond your own experience.
We are talking about great reads of 2022 with B.J. Hollers from UW-Eau Claire, an author himself. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What have you been recommending this year? What is new, either this year or new to you, that you've discovered that you're loving? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, you teased this one, BJ. Video game creators in a novel called Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow.
That's correct. It's by Gabrielle Zevin. Of all the novels I read this year, this one really hit me in an unexpected way. It's the story of Sam and Sadie, two longtime friends who kind of had a falling out in their youth. They reconnect in their college years. They find this shared love of creating video games. And then the beautiful part of this book is that throughout the remaining part of the book, it's about their personal and professional relationships kind of blurring, but also kind of shown through the lens of video gaming. So the beauty of a video game, of course, is that sometimes your character dies and you get to restart and learn a lesson and try again. Real life isn't quite so flexible. And so kind of seeing their lives and relationships evolve through that lens was really poignant.
Now, are you a video game person yourself?
You know, not so much. And that was also what I thought was so cool about this book. If you love video games, you'll love this book. If you don't love video games, sort of like me, you'll probably still love this book.
All right. That's Gabrielle Zevin, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Now let's jump over to the nonfiction world. You shared a title, A Civil Rights Queen, Constance Baker Motley and the Struggle for Equality.
Yes. Oh my gosh, this was a great read. Tomiko Brown-Nagin is the author. I am a big sucker for a book whose notes section is like as long as the narrative, and this is very much that. This book is so meticulously researched. I was so impressed by that. But what's cool about it is it kind of reads like a novel. So a bit about the woman, Constance Baker Motley. She was born in Connecticut in 1921, a Black woman, went on to get her law degree, became a clerk for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, the first Black woman to argue before the Supreme Court, went on to be a state senator. It's a cool story because it's not just like about her meteoric rise. That would be one way to write this book, but it's also about how she had to break the glass ceiling and then realize too that she only did so by playing within a system that doesn't always allow for that glass ceiling breaking. And so one last kind of personal note I'll share about this, which was so fun for me. I was reading this Sunday morning. There was a chapter about the University of Alabama's desegregation, which Constance Baker Motley was very much involved in. And I noted these similarities to a book I wrote about that exact topic. I went to the notes section and sure enough, the author had used my book to write this one little spot. It was such a cool feeling to know I'd had some very small part in a book I now love, written by Tomiko Brown Nagin.
That's a pretty cool feeling. Now, I haven't read this one. What I like in biographies sometimes is, yeah, you meet the person, but you kind of get that life and times, the historical context they came out of and grew up in. I'm guessing, for what you're saying, this book, Civil Rights Queen, really does that.
Oh my gosh. And that's part of the beauty of when I write these kind of books, I love going through old newspapers, see what was on the movies at that time, you know, who won the sports events there in this particular time, just kind of get an ambiance of that moment in time. In this book, I mean, the names in here, Medgar Evers, James Meredith, Adam Clayton Powell, Martin Luther King, of course, JFK, Lyndon Johnson. It's this cast of characters kind of personalized in a really wonderful way.
Now, here's That Civil Rights Queen by Tomiko Brown Nagin. Now, going back to fiction, this is staying with the historical theme, though. Ken Follett. Now, I read his Pillars of the Earth and I think something else by Ken Follett. I like Pillars of the Earth a lot. It ended up being a trilogy, I want to say, set in medieval England. A prequel called The Evening and the Morning.
This is just pure fun, guilty pleasure read. I mean, this thing clocks in at like 928 pages, but you can read it in like 7 hours.
Oh,
the
wow.
Pages just blur. Maybe not 7 hours, but you know, it goes fast. And what's cool about it, as you mentioned, it's actually a prequel to Pillars of the Earth, which is a very well-known book about cathedral buildings. So this one is set around 1000 CE, and it brings together the story of this modest boat builder and a Norman noblewoman and a monk with these very big ambitions, all of whom find their lives turned upside down in the aftermath of a Viking attack on the shores of modern day Britain. So if you've read anything from Follett, you know this guy can time travel you anywhere. You know, he will take us to the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, and you will feel like you've lived half your life there. So that's very much the trick he pulls off again here.
Yeah, I think historical fiction, sometimes I run into like, okay, this feels like a very modern book, a modern conversation, and just with a set in the backdrop of a historical period. That's not what I get in Ken Follett, right? Like, he really tries to capture the flavor of what it was like to live in whatever era he's writing about.
You know, that is exactly it. And I mean, can I throw in a personal experience related to that very topic? I got this book right after I came back from teaching a course in England last summer. So it's like August, and I feel like I really know the history of England all of a sudden since I was just there. And I open this book and I see the names of rivers I walked by and the cities and the cathedrals. And so it was just so true to life. Even 1,000 years later, I could see the same things. I could feel the same emotions. And so that's really a credit to Ken Follett.
Okay, we're going to start moving a little closer to home now. We'll go to Chicago before we stop here in Wisconsin. Last summer on State Street, a little more literary fiction, you say?
Absolutely. I am certainly no book snob, but I do love a good literary fiction piece now and again. And so this is the debut novel of Toya Wolf, a wonderful writer, a wonderful person. It's set in 1999 in the Chicago Housing Authority's Robert Taylor Holmes Projects. And it's the story of four 12-year-old girls in the south side of Chicago, kind of growing apart, amid a very complicated backdrop of friendship lost and found. So it's told retrospectively through our main character, and it kind of reflects on this pivotal moment in their lives. The back cover says, quote, a striking coming-of-age debut about friendship, community, and resilience set in the housing projects of Chicago during one life-changing summer. And that perfectly sums up what this book is all about.
We're talking to BJ Hollers, author and associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. He's sharing some of his favorite new books of the year. You can, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you read any of the ones that BJ has mentioned so far? Do you have new books that you've been recommending to friends and family this year, or maybe one that somebody recommended to you? Did you discover a new author, even if their book wasn't brand spanking new in 2022? That is okay. Call in and let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We got some a bunch of recommendations, actually, from you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah says, Lessons in Chemistry, a new novel by Bonnie Garmus, and The Firekeeper's Daughter, a YA novel from 2021 by Angeline Bouly, were two of my favorites this year. Liz says she's currently reading The Woman They Could Not Silence by Kate Moore. Liz writes, it's a fascinating and disturbing look at the abuses imposed on women by some husbands, doctors, and institutions in 19th century America. Liz says, I highly recommend. How about you? What are you highly recommending in the book world? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, we've got BJ's book list for this year linked at WPR.org/Central Time. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about some great new books of 2022. BJ Hollers is with us, Associate Professor of English at UW-Eau Claire, author of several books himself, including The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. Got a full list of his book recommendations at WPR.org/Central Time. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your own recommendations. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller. Ingrid is with us in Westby. Ingrid, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Ingrid?
The best book I read all year is by John Armbruster. It's called Tailspin. It's his first book, and it's about a man from Soldier's Grove who fell out of an airplane in World War II and lived to tell about it.
Wow.
An amazing story.
That's great. You're going to look for a few. Is this like a fictionalized version or a nonfiction book, Ingrid?
No, it's not fiction.
Okay.
John's done a lot of research on the book. It's historically accurate, and it's just a tremendous read.
Interesting. Ingrid, thanks a lot for sharing with us. Well, that sounds like a story, BJ.
Sounds great, and you had me hooked at research. I'm a big fan when you can do that kind of thing. What a great story. Thanks, Ingrid.
Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Well, let's stay in Wisconsin. You've got a couple on your list. An essay collection, first of all, Here on Lake Halley by Patty C.
Yes, it's a great book. And full disclosure, Patty is a friend, a colleague of mine. We actually both share some newspaper space as part of the Sawdust Story series here at the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram newspaper. And so a lot of the essays in this collection were actually born from the columns that she's written for the newspaper. It's a great book from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. It came out late last summer. And really, it's just this poignant portrait of a small town, a village, actually, right up the road from us here in Eau Claire, Lake Halley. As it's kind of a celebration of the people there. The subtitle is Bar Flies, Fix It Guys, and Other Folks in Our Hometown, which I just love. It essays range from supper clubs to ice fishing to cribbage. It kind of reminds me of like Spoon River Anthology, Winesburg, Ohio, Population 45, all wrapped into one. It's a lot of fun for people who want to know more about the land where we live.
Here on Lake Halley. By the way, just got a note, John Armbruster, author of Tailspin, was on the Larry Mueller Show. So you can check out the WPR.org archives if you want to hear more about that book. Another Wisconsin recommendation, you have a novel this time, Still True by Maggie Ginsburg, a Wisconsin author, I think, and set in Wisconsin. Do I have that right?
Absolutely right. It's set in the small fictional town of Anthem, Wisconsin. It's the story of Lib Hansen, a woman who finds her 40-year-old son, whom she abandoned as an infant, suddenly re-entering her life, kind of upending her life in many ways. But it's also the story of her relationship with her longtime partner, Jack, who befriends a 10-year-old. They begin building bikes together. And what's interesting about this book is how Lib and Jack, though they've been together for some time, they're actually neighbors. They choose not to live together. And so I think there's this idea of distance makes the heart grow fonder, kind of personal space, finding love in a variety of methods and in distances, I suppose.
And we also heard from Ron in Menominee, who couldn't stay online, wanted to give a shout out to Jeff Anania, who writes crime stories set in northern Wisconsin and the Hayward area. You know, BJ, we don't need to go around the world. We got a lot of good writing going on here in Wisconsin.
It is so true. I mean, I'm reminded of Victoria Houston, who has a lot of good fishing mysteries. She was recently in the area, and it's just so cool to see all the great work that's happening right here.
We heard from Jocelyn on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, my favorite was A Shock to the System by Simon Brett, fast-paced mystery impossible to put down. And Jocelyn goes on, I didn't know BJ Hollers was here in Wisconsin. My favorite book from 2021, Jocelyn says, was written by him, called Flock Together. A fascinating true story about the exhaustive decades-long search for a thought-to-be-extinct bird called the ivory-billed woodpecker, a subject I knew absolutely nothing about. The book was just riveting. That's one of yours?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's very generous. I was not expecting that. But no, I love the opportunity to write that book. So far, we have not found that extinct bird, but we're still looking.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot for that comment, Jocelyn. Back to our callers now. Margo is with us in Menominee. Margo, hi.
Hey, Rob. Just want to recommend the book, The Farmer's Lawyer by Sarah Vogel, nonfiction, written about her successful lawsuit against the federal government in which she took on the USDA for discriminatory practices against farmers. And it was a class action lawsuit, and she won. And then she was elected the first agriculture commissioner of North Dakota who is female.
Margo, thanks a lot for sharing that recommendation. If you want to hear more, Sarah Vogel was on the show talking about that very book. That's another one. You could check the archives at WPR.org. That's along the lines of another good law and history one, like the Civil Rights Queen book, BJ.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It's funny how these topics and themes do kind of continue to emerge.
And thanks for that, Margo. Speaking of staying on the theme of people who have been on this show, a piece of nonfiction you recommend, Alexandra Lang, Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. And I thought this one was super interesting. I got to talk to the author on the show and of course, read the book leading up to it. You know, the mall was just something we took for granted as kids. Really fascinating history, though.
Oh, that is so cool. You got to talk with her. You know, I just kind of stumbled upon this book a couple weeks ago. I love it. First of all, I love the title, Meet Me by the Fountain. How many times did I say that as an adolescent, you know? And so, as you mentioned, it's this nonfiction book that kind of digs deep into the rise and fall of the modern shopping mall. It's kind of this part cultural history, part architectural history, part personal reflection about how the mall kind of represents the privatization of a public space. I mean, the malls, of course, have their own benches, trees, security details, their own food and drink, their own kind of habitat. But what happens when you leave that habitat and move back to the wider world? So just a really fun way to look at someplace we go a lot in an entirely new way.
We are getting some great book recommendations, new stuff in 2022. BJ Hollers is with us from UW Eau Claire, author himself, sharing a wide variety of books. Check out the full list at WPR.org/Central Time. Still time for you to sneak in with a call at 800-642-1234. If you have a recommendation to share, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Got a couple more on your list I want to get to. This one, this wouldn't have maybe been on my radar right away. Kind of a memoir by somebody who'd been a child star. I'm Glad My Mom Died is the title.
Yeah, talk about a title, right? It's by Jeanette McCurdy. It's a brand new memoir. Jeanette McCurdy is a child actor made famous for a 2000s era Nickelodeon show called iCarly. I don't know anything about this show. You don't need to know the show to enjoy the book. It's not a traditional actor's memoir. Instead, it's this highly personal account of Jeanette McCurdy's mother's micromanaging of her career and her life, how her mother controlled every calorie, every physical appearance related thing, her grooming, her dating life, and often kind of the long-term negative effects of these parenting decisions. And so this book really goes to some dark places about McCurdy's eating disorders, her addiction. But in the end, I think there's some nice empowerment about how to go through that. There's a famous line that Mary Carr, the memoirist, asks writers to do, which is, what would you write if you weren't afraid? And I feel like this book is the answer to that question.
Memoir is something I don't always seek out, honestly, BJ. Are there others you'd steer me toward that kind of fit that guideline you just mentioned?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm with you. I mean, sometimes memoirs feel like navel gazing, like you're just going so close. Honestly, these days I'm reading so much historical stuff. I don't read a ton of memoirs myself. I think Wild, of course, is like the memoir from the last 10 years. Everyone's reading Wild by Cheryl Strayed. And indeed, that's a fun one to come back to.
And then we've got The Many Daughters of Afong Moy. This is a novel by Jamie Ford. And this looks like sort of an epic scale sort of thing, but very deeply personal, too.
Absolutely. You said it exactly right. It is epic in many ways. What's so cool about this book is that it's kind of part historical fiction, part speculative fiction. This book weaves together the past, the present, and the future, all around this singular idea of epigenetics, which is kind of the scientific theory that trauma can pass from one generation to the next. And there's scientific proof of this now, which is really interesting. And so it talks about Afong Moy. It's kind of the anchor of the book, who was the first Chinese woman ever to come to America in 1834. And then the book kind of splinters off into these five different characters of Afong Moy's future generation relatives, you know, and kind of how their lives changed and the traumas they have as a result of Afong Moy's initial traumas.
in our last couple of minutes, we've got, you know, the holiday season coming. Maybe we get a few days off depending on travel plans and things like that. Are there types of books you turn to when you think, okay, I've got a few days work, you know, maybe I could set aside for a bit and really just dig into something?
Oh gosh. I mean, I do find I love a good thriller these days, just to take my mind away from everything else. So there's an author named Greg Iles who has this trilogy of kind of civil rights era mysteries. They kind of, again, bridge the past with the present, and they're just really fun, again, page turners. So those are kind of my guilty pleasure reads.
And is there, again, you mentioned you read a lot of history for your own research and work, but it sounds like also for your own edification. Is there a period of history you're particularly zoomed in on lately?
Well, I'm hard at work on a book on JFK's primary in Wisconsin, actually, 1960 primary. It was a make or break primary for Kennedy. He ended up beating Humphrey, of course. Had he not, he would have thrown in the towel. And so I've been very curious about that particular moment. So I've been digging pretty deep into the Kennedy early years.
Do you have a title yet? We need to let the other shows know they can't have it.
Sure. It's coming out with Wisconsin Historical Society Press. It's called Wisconsin for Kennedy. Subtitle might be something like The Primary That Made a President. So something like that.
BJ, thanks so much for sharing all these great reads with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Rob.
That's BJ Hollers, Associate Professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. We talked with him about some of his favorite new books of 2022. You can find the full list of his picks on our website at WPR.org/Central Time. You can keep the book conversation going. Let us know your favorite new books, favorite authors from this year over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've heard from some more of you. James wrote, Kindra Neely's Numb to This, a powerful graphic novel. I think that one's by a survivor or a body survivor of a mass shooting, if I'm not mistaken. Thanks for sharing that with us, James. Kathy wrote American Dirt. That's a novel from 2020 by Janine Cummins. Sarah wrote, I'd read that one already. Sharon wrote Blue Lake by Jeffrey Bolt. Thank you all so much for sharing those great reads. Coming up, a case before the U.S. Supreme Court raises issues of free speech and discrimination. A court watcher tells us what's at stake. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you remember clapping along to, say, Miss Mary Mack when you were younger, or folding up a piece of paper to make one of those origami fortune teller deals? We talked to a writer about the shared games, legends, and rhymes that become traditions of childhood, often through generations. Now in the U.S. Supreme Court, there were oral arguments yesterday in the case 303 Creative versus Elinus. Lori Smith, owner of a graphic design business in Colorado, creates wedding websites for marriages only between a man and a woman. That ran afoul of a Colorado state law requiring commercial businesses not to discriminate on the basis of, among other things, sexual orientation. In a court challenge, Smith's attorneys argue that requiring her to create websites for people in same-sex marriages, which she opposes, would amount to government-mandated speech. Colorado state lawyers say same-sex marriage is legal and businesses shouldn't discriminate based on that status. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should someone, in this case a website creator, say, no, not going to provide services for people in a same-sex marriage, a same-sex wedding? What do you think about the issues at stake here? How do you want to see the court rule? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kimmy King is with us, professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back.
Before we get to this case argued yesterday, some people may be looking at some of the basics and thinking, wait, didn't we already do this with that cake case also in Colorado?
Yeah, and sort of we did. In the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, at issue there was whether a cake maker could be forced or compelled to produce baked items that were to go to a same-sex marriage. There, the issue, however, was very narrowly decided. In that case, Colorado, same state, same Human Rights Commission, found that, in fact, the baker could be forced to bake that cake. When it gets to the Supreme Court looks at the record and says, wait a minute, Colorado Human Rights Commission, you have previously told people who didn't want to, who wanted to have messages that were of hate, right, about either the KKK or the Nazis or their opposition to same-sex marriage, and said that though they do not have to be compelled to say those kinds of things. So the court in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case basically said that only you, Colorado Commission, and the way you behaved in this case is why we're reversing the decision. And they did not address the broader issue of whether you can be compelled to create the case or to create the cake, only that the person had been treated, had been discriminated against in being forced to make the message. So it was a very narrow ruling.
Okay, here we replace cake with website. I summed up very briefly the arguments, Kimmy. Can you take us through the arguments on both sides? First of all, the plaintiff saying, I want to design wedding websites, but only for one man, one woman in this marriage. My personal beliefs don't recognize same-sex marriage. What is the argument from her and her attorneys here?
Yeah, it's slightly different than what the original case had been briefed regarding. There, they had raised the religious liberty issue. What the court focused on here was the artist, the website designer, is saying, no, if this is about the message, you are compelling me because I developed this website in consultation with you. You are forcing me to create something. It's like the Phillips Masterpiece Cake Shop case. You're forcing me with my message to send a signal about how I feel. And the court has previously said that people cannot be compelled by government. So they focused on the compelled speech argument, not as much as the religious liberty. The opposing counsel argued, said, well, if you allow this, then what's to keep someone from saying, I don't want to do a website for an interracial couple? I don't want to do a website. It was raised in a clip for disabled persons because I don't think disabled persons should get married. What does that do to our laws regarding public accommodations that when you hold yourself out to the public, you have to treat everyone equally?
Now, I want to talk about what this doesn't cover. If this is something like a realtor or somebody who provides mortgages, say, or a hotel chain, this wouldn't talk about them, right? This isn't, those wouldn't be creative expressions. Those are a different kind of accommodations.
That's correct. It's a compelled message. And there's also an important distinction between identity, being LGBTQ, and the message that is being created. Lori Smith, the person who creates the website, the party involved in this case, has said, I have LGBT clients. I do all sorts of things with them, but I don't develop websites for their marriages. It's about the message as it relates to same-sex marriage that she is opposed to.
Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, looking at this U.S. Supreme Court case yesterday, web designer saying, I don't like this Colorado state law that says I would have to do a website for a same-sex couple. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, your hopes for the outcome, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, to that point you were just talking about there, Kimmy, I want to give a listen to Justice Amy Coney Barrett, clarifying with Smith's attorney about the case. Here's a listen.
A heterosexual couple comes to her and in the engagement story part writes a story that goes like this. We met at work. We were both married to other people. But what began as late nights at the office quickly turned into love. After 6 months, we realized we could be happy only with each other. So we decided to begin our story today, got divorced, and are marrying each other. Does she publish it?
I don't believe that she would. I also don't believe that she would embrace or express a message that would essentially say it doesn't matter whether there is a marriage between a man and a woman. She wouldn't create that speech.
So it's about the message and not about the sexuality of the couple that asked her to express it that matters.
Yes.
So it seems like some sympathy to that that argument, at least from one conservative justice, Kimmy.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only that, but recently in the National Institute of Family and Life Advocates versus Becerra, there had been an issue in California which required all licensed and unlicensed centers that provided reproductive health services to women that they post a notice that if they were pregnant, that there was access to low-income abortion and reproductive health access. Pro-life forces argued and said, this is compelling speech. You are forcing us to put on our signs and to provide that information to clients that says that abortion is an option. And we disagree with that, you know, for religious reasons. The court in the Becerra case, 5-4, said, yep, that's right. That's government compelling speech. And that's why, you know, you can't be forced to do it, pro-life group. The liberals were in the minority. That decision was 5-4. The court has already found that government can't compel speech in that context. It should be no surprise when I think the court will come in 6-3 on this case because it's grown more conservative and find that this is, in fact, compelled speech.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Beloit. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. There is nothing in the Christian Bible that states anything that God don't want you to be gay. As a matter of fact, God sent the Son to die for all sins of all people. And if this woman thinks gay is a sin, then her job is to engage, pray, and forgive.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And it's interesting, Kimmy, based on what you said earlier, that the argument turned from kind of a religious liberty case where Mike's comments might be more relevant to a compelled speech and a free speech case where they're not so much relying on saying, hey, this violates my religious beliefs. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that's why you see Amy Coney Barrett kind of feeding the question to the counsel for the website designer about, look, you're on firmer ground when you talk about the message that is being communicated, not about the beliefs. I mean, to the point of what your caller is making, and that's a strong point, and it's part of why we're so polarized on this issue between the public view of how people should be treated and the private opinions that people have. In the recent Senate amendments to the Marriage Equality Act, they point out that if it's a nonprofit group or a religious group, that they cannot be forced to provide goods or services. That's specifically in the Senate Act. Now, that only applies to nonprofit groups, religious groups. It doesn't apply to private businesses. And that's why this case has so much relevance. And I think that's why, as your caller's pointing out, the court's going to try to avoid that controversy and decide it under the compelled speech doctrine.
Thanks for that call, Mike. Kimmy King is with us, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, one of our go-to guests on all things U.S. Supreme Court related. Looking at this case heard yesterday involving issues of free speech, discrimination, and same-sex marriage, you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you watching for? What are you hoping for from the U.S. Supreme Court? Do you have questions about what's going on here, what it could mean? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, looking at a free speech, discrimination, and same-sex marriage case in the U.S. Supreme Court. Oral arguments yesterday. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Kimmy, I want to give a listen to Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Bringing up an issue that you had alluded to earlier, sort of where's the line and what's next? Here's a listen.
But how about people who don't believe in interracial marriage? Or about people who don't believe that disabled people should get married? Where's the line?
A lot of hypotheticals and what ifs. What about that particular argument, Kimmy?
So this is where it starts to get difficult, right? The idea behind our public accommodations laws is that when you hold yourself out to the public, you as a person coming into that business, whether it's a restaurant, trying to get a cake made, you know, wanting to set up a website, deserve to be treated equally. And you really saw Sotomayor and Kagan and even Ketanji, you know, the new Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, go after the counsel for the website designer about what the implications would be. She got herself into a little bit of trouble. You saw Alito come in and try to help her out a little bit. Thomas did as well. But at the end of the day, she held tight to this idea that if there is a message that you are being forced to create, then it's something that is compelled speech and the government cannot do it. And she pointed out that 20 states already have laws on the books relating to this exact kind of public accommodations question as it relates to marriage equality, because it's a distinctive issue. So maybe watch for the court to kind of limit it like they did in the Masterpiece Cake Shop and say, this is a narrow ruling that deals with the issue of marriage equality in a contentious issue that is relatively new in this court's jurisprudence, but compelled speech has a doctrine going back 70 years. In fact, it goes back to the fact that we can't force school children to salute and say the Pledge of Allegiance. So it has a long history of not letting government interfere with that communication.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in La Crosse. Jerry, hi.
Hello, hi. Well, that was my point, that a person advertising his business as a cake maker or a website provider is offering it to everyone. And I think it, a solution might be for anyone who wants to limit it to always be compelled to advertise that, yes, we offer this service to only Christians or only non-Christians or only Jews, you know, so that they're letting people know that they have this limitation. I don't understand why making a website is really a speech. I think it's just an art. It's a design. It's showing a picture of a couple people smiling at each other or something. It's not a speech. Anyway.
Jerry, thanks a lot for that call. A couple issues there, Kimmy. Let's start with that second one first, because that's is really at the heart of it. What is free speech? Is making a cake a free speech act? Is making a, you know, website, a kind of a cookie cutter layout website for a wedding announcement, speech?
Yeah, and to the point that your caller is making, it really is, it came up in oral arguments, exactly the point that he was raising. And that is, what if you have something that's like a plug and play, right? Where it's just a little template that you fill out all of the information. In this particular case, the website designer works with the couple. And so, you know, there's kind of a larger question here of why would you want to go to a business that doesn't want to respect your marriage and give them that business? But nonetheless, the point is that it's about the right. Think about the civil rights era, in which Blacks wanted to go to restaurants, they wanted to sit down and they wanted to eat. They didn't want to be served at the back window. The Supreme Court said, when you hold yourself out as a public accommodation, you can't deny based on somebody's race. That's about identity. To the caller's first part of the question, this issue of why couldn't you put a sign up? In this case, it's not sure what that would be, because the theory of the argument here is that it's about the message. So, you know, perhaps having a disclaimer that says, I have the right not to endorse any message of which I do not approve, that might be a potential for the window or the on the website or whatever it might be. But I think it would be much more narrowly limited in this case just because of the facts, and they focus so much on the message of endorsing marriage equality.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jerry. We'll go to Kane now in Milwaukee. Kane, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Yeah, so the whole conversation is about someone's choice to not support somebody. And I'm just wondering at what point does a person's choosing, you know, if you choose to be a Republican, all of a sudden now does that negate you from being able to get a latte at your favorite coffee shop? And at what point does that such transition to a point where it's so derivative of like, well, you know, now you've got 10 different coffee shops for 10 different types of people?
Okay, and thanks for the call. Kimmy, another, I guess, kind of slippery slope concern. What can be the basis for discrimination if the Supreme Court agrees with the plaintiff?
So the first thing you have to look at is it compelled speech? Mm-hmm. So that's going to be symbolic speech, making a latte, right? You're going to have to show where is the expressive content that is involved. So in the first, you know, the test requires you have to establish, is it in fact expression or speech? And then is it, you know, being compelled against the speech rights or expressive rights of the person who's seeking not to be forced to do it? In the employment context, they found consistently that there may be instances in which you may be compelled, like, to have to do it because it's part of your employment agreement that you have. This is a little distinctive because you don't have an employment contract. You're holding yourself out to the public with the hopes of some kind of contract. The caller's point is absolutely well taken. And in the arguments, it came up, you know, could someone who's a Democrat be compelled to have to write a speech for a Republican? That's kind of a hypothetical that doesn't really happen because that person would not be hired in the first place. And the court avoided getting into those sorts of hypotheticals.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kane. Elise joins us now in Ashland. Hi, Elise.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
Well, you know, one of the points that was raised earlier was, you know, the counsel for the web designer was saying that, you know, discrimination against queer people is controversial and therefore should be protected, whereas discrimination against disabled folks and people of oppressed racial backgrounds, shouldn't be. But that to me is, you know, that begs the question. Well, what happens then, as we are seeing now, when open discrimination and hatred against Black folks, against Jews, against disabled people becomes more mainstream and popular? By that argument, that should be protected too.
Elise, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left. What do you think, Kimmy?
So the question that you're getting at is a really good one and a really difficult one. I do want to be clear on what the attorney for the website designer, the attorney Wagoner, said. She focused exclusively on the message, not decrying or that it was discrimination. It's more that she, as the person as the website designer, could not in good conscience deliver the object that is requested by the couple that's seeking to promote their marriage equality. And that's where the problem becomes. There is a very important point here your caller is making. To what extent, if you say, look, you can start treating people different in public space, that's a slippery slope to starting to think that it's, you know, okay to carry out violence against people to accomplish your objectives of disagreeing with them. And that really was not any part of the court's view, and they weren't addressing that larger issue.
Thanks for the call, Elise. In our last minute, Kimmy, you mentioned you expect the conservative court to rule for the plaintiff here. It may depend, you know, how narrowly or broadly they rule. Do you think it's likely this is going to be the last case we see on these issues raised by accommodation issues in businesses dealing with same-sex marriage?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, these go to core values about how people believe and how we've changed in our views about these kinds of issues. And I think that part of what it will also do is it will spur people forward that where the change needs to come is from legislatures, and that you have to take actions to get them to protect those rights. And that's why the passage of the Marriage Equality Bill is a very important first step for persons wanting to protect LGBTQ rights. Strengthening hate crime laws to prevent the kind of violence against protected groups is also another route that I think that folks need to go. I think this idea that going to the court to protect your rights is not something that is going to continue to be the kind of fit frenzy that we've had. I think legislatures are going to start taking these issues up more.
Thanks to our guest, Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court case on free speech, religious beliefs, and discrimination, oral arguments heard yesterday. Are you looking for a good password for your computer or for a website? Don't look to the Mel Brooks classic, Spaceballs, for inspiration.
What's the combination? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5?
Yes.
That's amazing. I've got the same combination on my luggage.
Unfortunately, a lot of people may follow that trend. A new report from the company NordPass surveyed terabytes of password data to find the most common passwords. If I read this right, these are passwords that were revealed in cybersecurity breaches. The most common passwords of 2022, number one, password, all lowercase. Yes, the word password. The Spaceballs inspiration there was big, though. The top 10 list includes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and yes, the classic 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The cybersecurity lesson, don't do this. If you want to protect your identity or your luggage or your atmosphere, build a better password. This is Central Time.